So there literally was a point in time when you could have Googled the word failure and my face would have been one of your top search results. I hit all the same setbacks and mistakes that I did in my first company and my second company. Things were just as hard. But because I cared about it at an emotional level, because I really wanted to see this thing come alive, I was able to sort of be durable during those moments. I was able to sort of get through them because there was something deeper than outside achievement or success that really mattered to me.
Once seen as the face of failure on the New York Times, Sunil Gupta understands the road to success is not always smooth and requires more than unrelenting grit. Something we here, of course, know at Billion Dollar Moves. Things turned around for him, where as CEO of Rise, Sunil helped thousands of people in their physical and mental health journey. The company was named App of the Year, partnered with then First Lady Michelle Obama. Now a best-selling author, renowned speaker, Harvard Medical School visiting scholar, Sunil helps others achieve sustainable peak performance by embracing simple habits to bolster resilience and engagement. Core to that is what he captures in his book, Everyday Dharma. And today we unpack the wisdom of the pages on mindfulness, play in work, and how we can rise to our essence as leaders. You don't want to miss it. Welcome to Billion Dollar Moves. I'm Sergeant Spellings, and on the show, I travel across the globe in search of the unexpected leader. Every week, it is my job to deconstruct the billion dollar moves of unicorn founders and funders, many of them underestimated long before they became iconic. Many of them unexpected leaders just like you. This show is about unfiltered conversations on success, failure, fear, and courage in the pursuit of the next big thing in tech and venture. Now, before we hop in here, I have a quick favor to ask you. About 80% of the listeners of this podcast have yet to hit the follow button, and it would really help me out if you would smash that follow button wherever you're tuning in from. The bigger the show gets, the bigger the guests get, and the more stories we can amplify across the global venture ecosystem so that we can all keep making billion dollar moves together. Now, let's get started. We have Sunil Gupta, author of the brand spanking Everyday Dharma that I have been digging into and absolutely loving. Congratulations, Sunil, on this amazing book. But of course, this is not your first book. It follows a very different book, Backable. Tell us a little bit about that journey and who is in front of us.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. There's a quote that Pablo Picasso has, which I always think about, which is that the meaning of life is to find your gift and the purpose of life is to give it away. And my last book, Backable, was really about how do we give our gift away. So if you have an idea, if you have a vision, how do you get people inspired to follow that? But this book is really about how do we find that gift in the first place? And how do we know we're on the right path? And the more that I've dug into what I do, which is I study people who have ultimately achieved great things in their life, but I try to go back to the moments where they were losing, go back to those moments where they felt like they were empty inside or they weren't getting what they wanted. Ultimately, the big flip for people was really when they started to, I think, come into their own and understand who they are and how who they are gets expressed through what they do. It's what my ancestors would call dharma, living your dharma. And dharma is your essence. It is this thing inside of you that really wants to speak. And when you're expressing that essence, you come alive in a brand new way. You feel confident, you feel creative, you feel energized. And when you don't, you feel lost and you feel depleted. And the reason that this book was so urgent for me is because not only was it something that I felt like I needed in my life, but I think so many of us are feeling that way right now. We're feeling this emptiness. And I think it's, for most of us, the number one determiner of our mental health is our job. It's our work. It's what we do each day. And yet so many of us feel unsatisfied right now with how we're spending our time. And so the question for us is, how do we start to bring this idea of dharma into our life? And how do we do that when we're busy, when we're overwhelmed, when we have back-to-back meetings, we have bills to pay, we have kids to drop off, we have aging parents, we have all these other priorities in our life? How do we start to really think about this idea of dharma and purpose and fit it into what already seems like an overwhelming life?
Yeah. And to arrive at this thought process, sounds like it's been years of trial and error, many failures in between. And in fact, for you, in your journey, you were once the poster child for what failure means, which is very much not something our Asian parents look forward to after all the bills that was played. And I believe you also went through the law degree in law school. I didn't end up putting that completely into practice. Tell us a little bit more about that chapter and how you changed that around.
Yeah, just like anybody else, I wanted to be seen as a success. One day I get a call from a conference organizer who says, hey, yeah, you have been nominated to be a keynote speaker for our conference. And I said, well, that's wonderful. What's the name of the conference? And she says, FailCon, which literally stands for Failure Conference. At that point in time, I had started two companies that did not succeed. So I'm on stage and I'm speaking about these failures. And I didn't realize this, but there was a reporter from the New York Times in the audience. You fast forward to a full-length article on failure with my face as the cover of this article. This is right around the time when failure was a topic that we went from not talking about to all of a sudden it seemed like everybody was talking about it. And this article came out right around that time. So it was highly viral. It was shared many times. So there literally was a point in time when you could have Googled the word failure and my face would have been one of your top search results. And I'm literally the poster child for failure. Somebody gave me a piece of advice around that time, which I always took to heart, which is that long-term success can come from short-term embarrassment if you can do something with it, if you can learn something from it. So what I decided to do is I started to email and share this article out to all these people that I admired, people who had no idea who I was, but from Oscar-winning filmmakers to celebrity chefs to leaders of large iconic companies to coaches of professional sports teams, people who I thought had reached the top of their game. And I would literally email them a link to this article and I would say, hey, as you can see, I don't know what I'm doing. Would you be willing to give me some advice? And the response rate to that email was just extraordinarily high. I think part of the reason for it is because I wasn't reaching out under this penumbra of success. I was throwing my failure on my sleeve. And I think that there was something that was touching about that to people. But more than that, it wasn't just that we started to have conversations. It was that it paved the way over the next 10 years to hundreds of honest, vulnerable conversations with all these people who, if you look them up, you're going to see a version of their story that they weren't sharing or that people weren't writing about, but all of a sudden I found myself hearing about. And it really was about these slumps that we can find ourselves in. And over again, what I started to realize is that so much of getting out of that slump is about this alignment between who we are and what we do. Right? So we can be doing things and we can be winning to a certain extent. We could be getting the achievements, we could be getting the accolades, we could be getting the status, and we could be getting the wealth, and yet we can still feel empty on the inside. And we know that happens all the time. Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar at Harvard University called this the arrival fallacy. The arrival fallacy is this notion that one day you're going to hit this level of status or wealth or success, and that once you get to that, past that threshold, you're going to feel this sense of fulfillment on the inside. And yet, that doesn't really happen. It's a fallacy because every time we hit a goal that we think is going to give us this lasting sense of joy, the goalpost moves again and it moves again and it moves again. And so we find ourselves on this hedonic treadmill where we're chasing something always, but we're never quite getting the feeling that we're after.
Yeah, so two ways I want to take this. The arrival fallacy was very early on in the book and a concept that definitely a lot of our listeners have felt and may be going through at this point in their lives. At the same time, I wanted to dig a little bit deeper in terms of turning failure into something that you can use. Of course, beyond your two companies, you also ran for public office. So you've lost pretty publicly throughout your life in many different chapters as an entrepreneur, as wannabe politician. And yet you turned it around and managed to build a success story with Rise, selling that to Amazon. How did you take that from being disappointed with yourself and feeling that there is no end to using it maybe as a good chip on your shoulder to progress and move forward beyond that slump?
For me, it began with working on something that really mattered to me. Companies that I'd started before, I thought they were very interesting market opportunities, but they didn't necessarily tap into something that I really cared about. I said to myself, I'm going to start one more company, and if it doesn't work, then I'm done being an entrepreneur. And I remember sitting down with a mentor of mine, and I had created this almost like business school spreadsheet. It was like column A, I had a bunch of different ideas, and column B was like market size, and column C was competition. It was like very McKinsey-esque. And I remember she looks at the spreadsheet, and she looks at me, and she says, let me ask you a question. which of these ideas makes you come alive? And I'm like, well, I look at row C, that's a really interesting opportunity because, you know, big market, not a lot of consumers. No, I didn't ask you that. I asked you which of these ideas actually sets you on fire, like really means something to you. And I look at the spreadsheet and I realize that none of them really do. I thought they were good business ideas, but I didn't care about them at that heart level. I ended up scrapping that spreadsheet and starting again. And what I started with was not the market size and not the competition, and all the other variables. That came later. What I started with was like, what do I absolutely feel like I need to do? What's the idea that I'm like dying to create? And for me at that time, it was coming off of my father's health journey. My father struggled with diabetes and heart disease and so much else in his life. It would only be during the doctor's visits that he was able to get sort of the care he needed, but 99% of the care he had was what he gave himself. The thing that helped him turn his life around was having a health coach. Insurance kicked in and helped him pay for somebody who really turned around his diet, turned around his lifestyle, his sleep, his exercise. I realized that in order to have somebody like that in your life, you either needed to be very sick, like my father was, or you need to be very wealthy, rich, which most people are not. So I wanted to figure out, could we start providing something like that to the rest of us? And that was an idea that made me come alive. Did I think it was going to be a good business? I don't know. In fact, it's actually a very difficult business for a lot of reasons to create and get off the ground. If I wanted to do something that just made money, I probably would have done something easier than that. But the point being, Sarah, that like I hit all the same setbacks and mistakes that I did in my first company and my second company. Things were just as hard. But because I cared about it at an emotional level, because I really wanted to see this thing come alive, I was able to sort of be durable during those moments. I was able to sort of get through them because there was something deeper than outside achievement or success that really mattered to me.
So you found your why that really drove you, and it's something that we talk a lot about here. I really like that word, durable, being durable through the tough times, because entrepreneurship is probably the hardest thing that many of us will do.
Yeah.
So you talk about the arrival fallacy and man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl and all of this in your book. And one particular phrase you wrote about struck me about how we are increasingly more aware of this arrival fallacy, and the next generation has probably seen it in our parents that we now have deeper questions of ourselves. How are you seeing this take shape in our generations? Are we the lost generation, unfortunately, or are we more inquisitive, whether this is a good or bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. I think the questions that we're asking right now, that we're seeing young people really ask, like right in high school or college or right out of college, these are good questions to ask, which is like, what is meaning behind my work? If you trace back a few generations, first of all, there's always been sort of a trade-off. I think as long as progress has existed, there's been a trade-off between money and meaning. And for a long time, I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that there was a point of view that money would buy meaning. If you created enough money and wealth in your life, you would be able to feel a sense of meaning from that. And I think that that's, for most of us, sort of the way our grandparents lived, maybe even our parents to a certain degree. With Viktor Frankl, with his research in Man's Search for Meaning, and Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor and he was a neurologist, he did extensive research. And one of the studies that he cited in his book was a massive study done by Johns Hopkins University from the National Institute of Mental Health in a partnership. And what they realized is that in the 1980s and 90s, we were starting to shift more towards meaning than money. So if prior generations had focused more on money than meaning, those generations were starting to say, well, I care about meaning just as much as I care about money. And I think that tide has continued to shift. Gen Zers, they're asking questions that sometimes annoy people who are older. But I think those questions are sort of the fair ones to ask, which is like, look, I'm entering the workforce right now. We're living longer than ever before. Plus, I don't know about some of the things that we have in place right now, like Social Security and healthcare insurance. We don't know what the status of that is going to be over time. A lot of that stuff is at risk right now. A lot of these safety nets may go away. And the punchline being that I may end up spending a lot longer, potentially decades longer in the workforce than my parents ever did, right? And to say that I want to actually pursue a career path that is meaningful for me, that isn't just about the rewards and riches that are potentially at the end of the rainbow, but the things that I actually enjoy doing right now, I think it's a very fair way to look at life. In a lot of ways, I think our parents are somewhat jealous that they didn't look about it that way earlier on. And I think we see that now in our parents who pursued wealth as a pathway to meaning and realize that that equation doesn't necessarily work. Now, that's, by the way, not to shame wealth. That's not to shame the idea of making money, because I think that stuff matters as much. You know, I grew up in outer Detroit, and there's a lot of people who don't necessarily have privilege of having some of the conversations that we have. And yet, I think all of us have this primal need to have a little bit of meaning in our life. And so oftentimes, I think the question that we need to answer is, how do we start to fit purpose and start to align more of who we are with what we do, even when we are overwhelmed with duties in our life? And that's really the reason that I wrote the book, because when you hear terms like purpose, it sometimes can like conjure up these images of quitting your job and becoming a painter in Florence, or like taking an extended backpacking journey through the Himalayas. That's not what purpose really is. And for the vast majority of us, they don't have the liberty necessarily to go do that with our lives. We need to earn a salary. We need to make money. And yet at the same time, we want to experience meaning in everything we do as well. And that comes through these little alignments. It doesn't come through ripping off a huge Band-Aid and like completely shaking up your entire life. It comes from these little things that we can do every single day.
The work that I do in investing, working with some really top performing, amazing funders and founders, I realized two things. One was, burnout would happen very quickly because they're typically very obsessed with the problem, right? They're so driven potentially by their dharma that they had to solve this problem, and they did it so well that they burned out. And then after they exited, because that was their soul dharma, they had no idea what was their purpose in life. So they lose themselves. And I see this very quickly. And the second situation that I would see and really observe is, a lot of my friends are different generations. I'm lucky enough to be a young global leader of the World Economic Forum. And David Rubenstein actually said this to us in a Harvard class last year. He said, I challenge you all to become true old global leaders of significance. If you think about the leaders around the world today, most of them are old global leaders, and very few who have been successful early have sustained that. And so many that I observe have struggled with the second act. You think Bill Gates, arguably, some people say his second act with the foundation is even bigger than Microsoft. But so many actually struggle with that. How do we overcome this? What are the elements of which we can actually be kinder and address this arrival fallacy?
Let's start with burnout. As a tip of the spear of the conversation, I think one of the things that takes us out of our dharma, out of this continuity of being able to sustain and do more and ultimately to build momentum in our lives and our careers, even past that exit, or whatever that win is that we end up reaching, is that we just get exhausted. We run out of fuel in the tank. And I think that that is way more common than we give it credit for. It's just physical, like actually physical exhaustion. I've gone out now and I've studied leaders over the past 10 years across all walks of life. And what I've realized is that the people who fizzle out, very rarely do they run out of time. Very rarely do they run out of talent. What they almost always run out of is energy. They simply just don't have enough gas in the tank to keep going. So they never reach that goal, or they reach that goal and they immediately fizzle out after that. And they get so tired and they're like, I'm done. They don't ultimately, I think, reach the potential that they could in their lives. We are fixated, I think, on managing time often because we've been trained to do that. We are in our calendar always. We're constantly projecting out how long it's going to take to do things. But what we're not accounting enough for is energy. And if you look at high performers, people who are able to sustain the momentum in their lives, and these are from athletes to artists to people in business and investing, they are not waiting for vacations. They are not waiting for long breaks in order to find these moments of rest in their lives. They're taking frequent, focused breaks every single day. Rest is built into their lives almost like a rhythm. And so I call this rhythmic renewal. Rhythmically renewing themselves throughout the way. And they use that. I think what they believe, and I've come to sort of see as real truth, is that a disciplined work ethic requires a great rest ethic. You have to build it into your life. One of the ways that we can do that is through what I call the 55-5 model, which is that for every 55 minutes of work, whenever possible, you're taking 5 minutes of focused, deliberate rest. And that 5 minutes can be really doing anything you want. You could be sipping on a cup of coffee, you could be taking a walk, you could be meditating if that's your thing, so long as it's deliberately non-productive. You're not trying to squeeze in just a little bit of productivity or squeeze in like a couple of looks at your iPhone at that time. You're like you're actually just taking the rest. And I think if you're listening right now, one of your responses to that might be, because one of my responses was, well, aren't I shrinking my output then? Because if I'm shrinking each hour, that will add up over time. The science and the data tells us is that each one of those 5 minutes is going to make the other 55 minutes far more effective, far more energetic, far more creative, far more collaborative, all the qualities that we associate with success. And not only that, but like when you come up and you show up in that way, that rubs off on the people around you as well. The mindset shift, especially when it comes to this durability that we're talking about, is that we think of rest as a reward for what we have just done. But I think we can shift that to what it truly is, which is actually a preparation for what we are about to do.
Yeah, hearing you say all of that, it makes complete sense. Where did we get this idea that we had to produce every single minute of the day? Where does this need to perform come from?
I think it's fueled by all sorts of things. It's fueled by comparison. It's fueled by competitiveness. I have an older brother who is extremely successful. His name's Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and he's on CNN. He's 10 years older than me. He's my best friend. He was like a second father to me growing up. But there's always sort of been this need for me to want to perform. And part of that has led me in directions that wasn't my own, right? Because I wanted to do things that my parents would see as equally successful or be equally proud or be equally standout. And it was those things that sort of drove me more than I really wanted. I started my career out as a speechwriter and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And at some point in time, I walked away from that path because I felt like it wasn't going to be remarkable. It wasn't going to be the kind of thing that was going to make my parents proud enough. Or it wasn't the kind of thing that was going to have an illustrious enough LinkedIn profile. And it wasn't going to make me enough money. So I walked away from this thing that I really, really loved, because at that point in time I said, like, what's the cool thing? What are all the cool kids doing? And it was being a tech entrepreneur. This was 2008. I was graduating from law school at the time. My intent at first was to go back to DC and continue down the path of speech writing. But instead, the iPhone had just come out and everybody was moving to Silicon Valley and everybody seemed like they wanted to be a tech entrepreneur. So I followed the crowd. As a result of that, I ended up spending many, many years walking a path that really, really didn't feel like mine. And I was doing it because I wanted to be perceived a certain way in the eyes of others. Things changed for me when I started to chisel back to who I was. And that's the thing about Dharma, is that sometimes we feel like it's this thing we have to go out and we have to go find. Oftentimes it's already within you. It's something that you've already tasted. It's something that you've already experienced. It could have been last week. It could have been as a child, but like your Dharma is already inside of you. But sometimes we just have to chisel back to that place. You know, Michelangelo would look at a block of marble and he would say the sculpture is already inside. We just have to chisel away the layers. And I think that Dharma is very much the same thing. It's already inside of you. And there are questions, there are certain things that we can ask ourselves that can start to give us a peek back into what that essence really is. And in the book, I go through what a bunch of these questions are and some of the ways that I was able to sort of chisel back to the sculpture inside.
But what was the one big question for you to really address this arrival fallacy?
I think for me, the question that I think is underrated is, what would you do for free? What would you do without compensation? Sometimes people get confused by that question because the immediate sort of notion is, well, but I can't do it for free. I need to make a living. I have certain financial goals in my life, and that is totally fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you can put those aside for a moment and just ask yourself, if I wasn't compensated, what would I have to do anyway? Right? What's that thing that is being compensated just by the work itself? That can be a very, very direct glimpse at something that is in your essence. The other thing I think is really important is to start to take a peek underneath the hood of your own dream job. So what I mean by that is, I meet a lot of people right now who are in a career path. It doesn't feel like it's really their own. They're not quite satisfied. They're not quite fulfilled. And they have some sense of like, okay, well, that's my dream job over that, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do it because I'm kind of stuck where I'm right now, or I need to go get an education in order to go do that, and I don't have the time or the resources. What we can often do is start to take a look under the hood of that dream job to understand what is it about that thing that really makes us come alive. And once we discover the essence of our dream job, we might be able to see that we can express that through different ways. In chapter one of the book, I talk about this project manager named Mila, and she's working inside a big company. She is miserable. Like, she doesn't like her job, and her job feels much more like a paycheck than a passion. And what she realizes about herself is that she really wants to be a teacher. But the problem is that she has family relies on her health care insurance. They rely on her salary. She's already far enough down this path. She's felt like she's actually invested quite a bit into schooling and all the stuff that got her to where she is. And so she feels pretty trapped. She wishes she could rewind the clock and go on a different path, but she went down the path that she's in right now and she feels stuck in it. And then one day, a mentor of hers asked her, "What is it specifically about teaching that makes you come alive?" And by going deep into that question, Mila went beneath the title of teacher and into what she really actually loves about teaching. And what she realized is that what she really loves about teaching is that she loves helping people grow. Like, that's her thing. That's her essence, right? And yeah, teaching was one way to express that essence, of course. But there were many other ways as well. So she ends up making a relatively small shift over time into a training role inside her own company, in fact, inside her own department. And once she makes that shift, everything changes. She goes from dreading her job to waking up with more enthusiasm and energy. She becomes a rising star in the company. Her husband notices, her kids see their mother come alive. And I think the myth is that we need to abandon our life in order to transform the way that we live. But oftentimes, these little adjustments, these little things are within our reach. Sometimes all we have to do is look under the hood of our dreams, like look into the essence of what is it about that thing that actually makes me come alive. Because if you go to that level, if you go to the essence level as opposed to the occupation level, what you might realize is that that thing is something that you can express where you are right now.
I love that example, and in particular, I love that story as well. But I want to ask you a question that I haven't heard being asked in all your past interviews. You talk about your hypothesis or your theory based on years of your work and experience in studying this. Is once we tap into our essence, our dharma, and by asking that question, the rest will follow, essentially. And yet, I challenge that a little bit because, you know, I'm in a world where I'm trying to solve for the gender venture investment gap. I see some really talented, some of the most brilliant entrepreneurs that are working hard on problems that sometimes, in the words of your last book, are just not venture backable. And they struggle for some passions from what I see. Is it the wrong passion or is it, you know, they're not thinking it the right way? But it's truly hard to monetize. You think about starving artists and things like that. Sure. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. So I'm not a believer that once you start to tap into your essence, that everything sort of unfolds naturally. In fact, I think oftentimes when we walk our path of purpose, what we're walking into is one of the most difficult things ever because we really care about it. And oftentimes rejections and everything that comes with it become more real. And oftentimes the path of purpose is a much more entrepreneurial path and we're putting ourselves out there more. We're more prone to the mistakes and the rejections of life. I think that oftentimes this confusion that the path of purpose is once you find it, it's all kind of roses from there. And it absolutely is not. We've both seen it. The thing that I would say, though, is that right now there is a conditioning where we are sort of looking for achievements and we're looking for success to define whether we are on the right path. The fuel of our life is really coming from these victories on the outside. I talk in this book as sort of outside success. It's the achievements, it's the status, it's the new lines that we can add to our bio. That is outside success. Inside success, inner success is really about joy and it's about fulfillment. And both are important. I don't think the answer is to say we need to renounce those things. But I think what we can do is we can start to shift from a single engine where we're relying on that in order to feel fulfilled into a dual engine where we're actually working on things that matter to us. And that's giving us energy as well. There will be times when you will not be getting outside success. But there will be this constant heartbeat of having worked on things that matter to you that will be fueling you all along. And not only that, you will start to feel the creativity and energy that we often do associate with outside success as well. Will it always happen? Absolutely not. You and I both know lots and lots of people who have put themselves out there and they have not gotten the outside success they wanted. But as I go back and I go into sort of their stories and I ask them, do you regret that? Is that something that you regretted? Very rarely do I find people saying, oh my gosh, that was something that really mattered to me. It didn't reach the goal that I wanted to, and so I should never have done that in the first place. Dharma is not just about the sort of idea that satisfaction will come not just from the achievements that we make, it will come from the actions that we take. And if you put yourself in a place where fulfillment is coming not just from the achievements, but from the actions, you start to become unstoppable over time. You start to kind of like figure things out. One of the things that's really, really important that there are multiple ways to express our essence. If there's something that you love to do and that thing isn't working, you can morph the way that you're expressing it. You started going after a startup because you really liked this idea of nurturing people. So you decided to start a healthcare company, but it didn't work. That doesn't mean that your Dharma journey is over. What it means is that there's another expression for that exact same essence. Come back to the center, come back to this idea of like, look, I want to do something that really helps nurture people's health. Let me find another way to express that.
Yeah. And I'm curious, in the words of Michelangelo, right? The Dharma, the essence, the core is always there. You just need to chip away at it to reveal it. Yeah. I'm curious because I've seen some folks with what we call now the portfolio career. Do you think we can have more than one Dharma?
I think we can have way more than one expression. What I find is that when I look at portfolio careers, I start to dissect, all right, what's the thing for people who do this very well, these portfolio careers, what's that thing that's sort of gluing them all together? What you'll often find is that there is an essence. There is a drive. It is something. And I think for you, like closing the gender gap, and I think being able to, I think, reach people, you know, my sense in our short time of knowing each other, Sarah, is like there's a real drive and a spirit to serve people who are underserved, who want as much a shot at opportunity as anybody else. And that's manifesting itself in these different ways. You have the show, you have the fund, you have all the stuff you're doing on the philanthropic side, but there's an essence that's driving all of that. So that essence is the engine, but the number of ways that you can express that are limitless. And what I imagine for you, just given sort of the journey you're on right now, is you're going to end up finding even more, like Billion Dollar Blank is going to end up being sort of manifested in many, many different ways. That when we start to kind of come to that place and we come below the occupation mindset and into the essence mindset, what's that thing that's really driving us? Suddenly, possibilities begin to open. We feel a lot more free because we're no longer in the mindset of like, my purpose is to become a doctor or my purpose is to become a venture capitalist. Because as soon as we put ourselves in that mindset, we become fixed. It's like now we have to get that one thing or we're not living our path. No, there's something about venture capital that really drives you. What is that thing? Get really, really specific about what that is. Maybe it's because you love dealing with first-time entrepreneurs. Maybe it's because you love that element of coaching that happens right away. Okay, now you know what that essence is. And yes, venture capital is one way to express that, but there are many, many others as well. And some of those ways are available to you right now.
Yeah, I love that. In essence, you believe that there's one true Dharma and that we express it in different ways, that it doesn't shift, essentially. Even as we evolve as people, it doesn't shift?
No, I think it does shift. I think the way we express it will morph and change over time. And I think our understanding of our own Dharma will change over time. You'll start to get more specific about what it is. For example, I know right now that my Dharma is to be a storyteller. I started to come back to that. And the way that I came back to that is through what I call in the book, the bright spots chisel, right? Which is ultimately, even if you're in a job right now you don't like, what are the bright moments in your day? The moments that are giving you real joy. And when I started to take a peek at my days inside tech, even though I didn't like my job, what I started to realize is that every element of storytelling really brought me alive. When I was hearing a customer story, when I was able to share that story with my team, that was stuff that really sort of made me come alive. And so I started to really double down on, I started to spend moments of my day before my work writing in a journal. And those pages ended up becoming over time paragraphs and pages, and eventually they became books. Your sense of your own Dharma can also get more specific. At that time, it was generic on storytelling. Today, I know exactly what kinds of stories I want to tell. I study the highest performers at their lowest moments. And inside those lowest moments are stories. And inside those stories are habits, their practices, their things that any one of us can use. And by the way, most of that stuff is much more relatable than what's at the top, because most of us are trying to get to that place. And also just because, like, success is a lousy teacher. There's not all that much to learn up here, but there's so much to learn down here. The point being that as I chisel more, I'm going to keep learning more about my essence. And as I get deeper, the ways that I can express that are also going to change and morph over time.
And one of the things that I love how you brought up joy and finding joy in sometimes unexpected places, you dedicate a whole chapter to play and how we need to integrate work and play, and the lines are becoming blurred. Can you share a little bit more about how we as adults can lean into this playful nature and integrate play into our lives?
For us, like, work and play have been so separated. And the way that you think about play is very different than the way that we think about work. And there's a different style of behavior for work, and there's a different style of behavior for play. What we also realize is that science has demonstrated that when that line becomes blurred, there's a level of performance that comes out of that that is unparalleled. There is a real notion and a real pattern of people who are able to blur the lines and actually be able to get the best work out of themselves. And I think Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, the author of Flow, was the person who really doubled down on this and showed this through science better than anybody else. And what Csikszentmihalyi said is that we all have an autotelic side to our personality and an exotelic side to our personality. And the exotelic side of us is the part that really cares about the achievement, that cares about the victory. And we're very goal-driven. And the autotelic side of us is much more about the process. And critically, it's not just that we like the process or focused on the process, but we embrace it and even enjoy the process. I think before Csikszentmihalyi's research, there was a real belief that if we looked at the top performers across industries, what we were going to see are people who lean exotelic, because we have both sides to our personality, but we were going to find people who leaned exotelic. And what he found was that there was an equal number of people, if not greater, who leaned autotelic. And again, it wasn't just that they were into the process. They actually, like, enjoyed. They were finding ways to bring joy to the process. Alex Lowe, the mountain climber, somebody once asked him, what is it that defines the best climbers in the world? And he said, it's simple. The best climbers of the world are the ones who are having the most fun. And that's something that I hear over and over again when I look at people who are, like, reaching the top of their game. They're starting to blur this line between work and play. In the book, I really call this, what I call this is a music mindset. When we listen to a song, we're not waiting for the end to experience joy. We're not waiting to the final note to say, all right, that is the moment that I was waiting for. We're finding ways to experience joy along the way. One of them is as simple as asking yourself, how can I have fun with this? Again, I'm guessing that if you're listening right now, you might have an allergic reaction to that because it's so different than the way that we've been conditioned. There's an element of seriousness that I think we have been conditioned to believe is essential for success. But in fact, seriousness can sometimes be a blocker into these states of flow that end up getting us to our peak performance. It's a sense of joy. It's a sense of playfulness that end up being the channels to get us to that place much more effectively.
And we could go on for hours really dissecting each chapter, but I wanted to ask you one question before I go into the rapid fire, which is, what is something that you, in this chapter of your life, actually want to talk about that maybe no interviewer has actually asked you before?
One of the elements of my book that I didn't include, but I'm like, I should have probably included that one, is what makes you jealous in life? If you're being honest about it, it can be a really good indicator of your essence. Now, part of the reason that we shy away from that question is because we see jealousy as a shameful emotion, something that we shouldn't want to have. But if we can remove the emotional charge behind that, then we can look at the information that it actually holds. It can actually start to tell you a lot about yourself. So, for example, before this, we were talking about Jay Shetty. Jay and I know each other now, and, like, we've spent time with each other, and I've interviewed him. But there was a long time where I was really jealous of Jay Shetty. And part of the reason I was jealous of him is because, like, super handsome Indian guy. My mother-in-law was, like, in love with him. But he also, like, had, like, massive follower base and doing very, very well. And I'm like, I found myself jealous of that. When I started to sort of compartmentalize or push that out, I started, like, curious about it. Okay, so tell me a little more, like, about this jealousy. What is it particularly? What I began to realize is that he was doing a really effective job at bringing East meets West. And he was taking these concepts that both of our ancestors practiced and break them down in palatable ways, like things that we can put into practice right away. That made me jealous. I sort of realized, like, how much that mattered to me. I learned about Dharma from my grandfather on a porch in New Delhi. I had great people in my life who really showed me this way of living. But as an Indian kid growing up in the United States, I rejected that. I rejected anything that felt Eastern, did anything that felt Indian, because all I wanted to do was fit in. It wasn't until I got to a point in my life where I felt completely lost and depleted and burnt out that I started to go back to this way of living called Dharma. Quite honestly, I think Jay was one of those people who showed me that it was okay. Because he wasn't shunning his, he was embracing them. And, you know, and I respect it just the same way that I respect an uncle that I talk about in the book who decided that he was going to wear a turban every single day in suburban Michigan, no matter how much harassment, no matter how much people made fun of him, even after the days of 9/11 when people would shout slurs at him, he wore that turban every single day because it was who he was. And he wasn't going to shy away from who he was because ultimately what he saw and what I now understand is that fulfillment is really about alignment between who we are and what we do. And when we start to lose that alignment, when we start to behave and act in ways that are not in line with who we are, that's when we begin to lose our sense of purpose, of community. We start to feel a hell of a lot more lonely. Our lives can start to feel like falling apart. And so jealousy can sometimes be one of those indicators. It can be one of those chisels that sort of can help us come back to the center, come back to who we are.
So Neil, I just have to ask this question because I think it's important in this moment. We are still feeling the effects of Asian hate. Do you think America is changing? I'm realizing as I'm even getting more involved in these different communities that the Asian identity is becoming a little stronger when we used to shy away from it. Where are we in America in this moment with regards to race and embracing identity and being true to who we are?
I think we're divided. The good news is that I think things are changing for the better. After exiting my company, what ended up happening was things in Silicon Valley became a lot easier for me. I had gone from somebody who was rejected as an entrepreneur, who had been rejected by many, many investors, and then all of a sudden I had an exit and I was being offered to start my next one, no questions asked. A lot of the investors who said no to me were like, I'll back your next thing, just tell us what it is and we're in. But I realized that, like, what was calling me more than anything else at that moment was to get involved with what was happening in the nation. It was 2016 election had just happened. Donald Trump had just become elected president. My hometown in Michigan had gone red for the first time. To me, I was like, this is different. I need to go back. I need to leave the bubble of Silicon Valley. I need to go back to Metro Detroit, and I need to get involved. Convinced my very understanding wife to leave our life in San Francisco, and we had just sort of gotten to the point where we could, like, make ends meet, and we were just starting to get into our flow there, and we had two kids, and we left. We went back to Michigan, and ultimately I ended up running for office. And I lost that election, but what ended up happening was I knocked on over 10,000 doors. And during that time, there were a lot of door slams. There were a lot of people who told me to get off their porch. There were a lot of people who called me, told me to go back to my own country. But I would say that that was the minority. And I would say that one thing was happening for sure is that I felt like the younger doors I was knocking on, even if they disagreed with me politically, they were definitely the doors that had more conversation and more curiosity. Mm. And that was the thing that gave me hope. There's no shortage of racism, and it's across all demographics. But I do have some hope in that I think that every generation, including, like, I see my kids and the way they are with their friends, even though they belong to a school that is predominantly white, I see a lot more inclusion. I see a lot more curiosity. And I think that gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you for ending with hope there as we now go to billion dollar questions. So this is rapid fire. First thing that comes to mind is usually the right thing, yeah? What is the Dharma men's guilty pleasure, we wonder?
My guilty pleasure is dance parties. I Ooh. Love to do just like private dance parties. Dancing is a great way to shake off steam. I started doing more research on this. If you look at animals that get into like conflicts, what you'll often see is afterwards, they'll like shake themselves off, like shaking off that energy. Dancing in a lot of ways was our way of adopting that behavior. We're shaking off some of this energy that we've been storing inside our bodies. So I do these like private dance parties now. Just shut the door, put on a good tune and dance.
So what is that one go-to tune that never fails you?
Well, you're getting like... so.
I'm getting deep here.
you are. I'm a huge, huge 80s fan. Like, huge 80s fan. And, like, it's going to sound easy, but, like, even Dancing With Myself by Billy Idol is, like, a go-to.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. All right. What would you tell your younger self?
I don't think my younger self would listen to me. But I think that what I would tell my younger self is that this thing that you love... called speech writing, as improbable as it seems right now, it's your path. It's what you love. And so stay with it.
If you could have dinner with any three historical or alive figures, who would they be and why?
Paulo Coelho, the author of The Alchemist. I would sit down with him. He's a very reclusive person, very hard to sort of track down. I've listened to every interview possible, but there's just not enough. Mahatma Gandhi would be on that list. And Bob Marley.
Oh, no questions asked there. Worst advice you've been given?
The worst advice I've been given is that if you suck it up right now and you do this thing that you hate, eventually it will be worth it.
Best advice?
Best advice is to not wait for joy, to actually figure out what it is that makes you happy right now and bring a little bit more of that into your life each day.
Lovely. And finally, Sunil Gupta, what will your legacy be?
I hope that my legacy will be that more and more people will realize that you don't have to wait for courage in order to take action. You can take action and you can let courage catch up along the way.
Love that. Start before you're ready. Sunil Gupta, ladies and gents, Everyday Dharma, ready in every bookstore and even on Amazon, wherever you find your books. Sunil, where can we find you? Where else can we follow your journey?
You can go to sunilgupta.com. But honestly, like, the journey is all captured in the book. And so Everyday Dharma, if you're not tired of hearing my voice, it's available on audio. Or if you like to read, it's in print where you find your books.
And thanks so much for tuning in this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow our socials on Sarah Chen Global to get the latest on the show. It would really help me out too if you enjoyed this to rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts and share your favorite episodes with a friend. I'm Sarah Chen Spellings, and you've been listening to Billion Dollar Moves.